Oh, God.
Oh, my God.
Sorry, I just ascended for a quick moment. I'm back.
Oh, my God. I watched it happen. Oh, no. Oh, no.
Are we doing well? I don't think we are.
I watched you completely dissociate. Completely. You were gone. You were gone.
I did. I was out of this body. Hello, and welcome to Poor Unfortunate Podcast. I'm Connor Perkins.
And I'm Caroline A. Meddy.
Welcome to any new listeners. It's great having you here with us. Please remember to hit follow or subscribe wherever you're listening to the podcast. That way, all of our new episodes download right to your device. You don't miss out on anything. And make sure that if you like the episode, you hit 5 stars and leave a rating. That way, other people can find the podcast. We're seen in search results, things like that, and your comments might be the difference between someone hitting play or not. And then for any of our returning listeners, hey girl, hey. It's so good to have you here. If you haven't hit follow or subscribe, or you haven't left a review, we're in the dark timeline, so please, thank you. Caroline, what's up? What's new?
So when you're listening to this, Turning Red will have released on Friday, March 11th on Disney Plus at no extra cost. So that's very exciting. I can't wait to watch that.
No extra cost. And then stuff that's happening also on Disney Plus, we got the trailer for Obi-Wan Kenobi. Oh my God. I think it's one of the best teaser trailers I've seen in a very long time. The narration in it is like really, really exquisite.
Yes, I'm
like,
so exciting.
This is a really, really good way of just like setting the tone of all of this. And Duel of the Fates comes in and I'm like,
Also, I watched West Side Story, which was released on Disney Plus, and I thought it was lovely. I really did. I loved it.
I did not watch it.
Watch it. I want to know what
you
think.
So I have no opinions other than I'm not a fan of West Side Story.
But you know what?
I know you aren't either.
Yes, exactly. And I there have been so many times, and I don't know why. It's not any fault of any production I've ever seen. I walk away from it on stage, and I don't feel what I want to feel. And this did it for me. I finally – it's like when I finally saw this one fantastic production of Romeo and Juliet where I'm like, that's what I want to feel when this play ends. That's what I felt about this. Yeah. It was great.
And then, you know, other Disney news. We've got the Festival of Fantasy Parade returning in the Magic Kingdom, which is great. What's not great is the fact that around 50% of the cast members who are typically involved in that parade are missing, have not been rehired. Yes. And it's very noticeable in the parade. It's very, very noticeable, which is a shame and just seems to be continuing the trend that we're seeing from Disney, particularly in Disney parks, where they are trying to essentially push the model of operating Disney parks to the breaking point and just operate it there. Like, it feels like we're doing a stress test on this and just see what happens, because the park has been filling to capacity. All the cast members who were laid off during the furlough have not been brought back on. Festival of Fantasy is returning. Other parades are returning. Other events are returning. Cast members are not being hired back in the numbers that they should have been. They're changing park policies overnight. The quality is being hurt by it all.
Yeah.
Not to mention the fact that now Lightning Lane is going to be available for viewing Festival of Fantasy. Which that's the thing that just sort of
so
like sent me over
rude.
The edge.
I'm like,
We are nickel and diming for every single, like, now people are going to pay.
Oh my God.
To have a good spot for the parade. Kill me.
Oh my God.
Where if we did what they do overseas, everyone sits down for the parade, then every spot would be a good view for the parade. I can't.
Oh my God, man.
So speaking of our disappointment in Disney, I don't know if anyone who is listening has been paying attention, but if you haven't, there's been some atrocious things happening with the Disney company, specifically around their politics, which, you know, fluctuate in terms of where they align themselves on any given day. So Caroline, let's talk about, because we need to talk about this, let's talk about Disney's response and Florida's Don't Say Gay bill. For those of you who don't know, Caroline's going to give us a little bit of background on what's going on. But you can consider this a mini rant for our full rant and rave episode. So we're going to devote some time here because it's worthy of our time.
All right, let's get started. So, background information. The Parental Rights in Education Bill, known colloquially as the Don't Say Gay Bill, has been passed by both the Florida Senate and the House and has reached the desk of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis to be signed into law, and that would go into effect on July 1st if it is signed. And he has given, up until now, it seems like every indication that he's planning to sign it.
Yeah.
So the bill limits what can be taught in the classroom regarding sexual orientation and gender identity. It would also allow parents to sue schools or teachers that cover these topics. According to the bill, lessons, and I quote, may not occur in kindergarten through grade three or in a manner that is not age appropriate or developmentally appropriate for students in accordance with state standards. And to that I add, that leaves so much room for people to just turn that into whatever they want to turn it into.
There's so much room for interpretation, and it's like lessons, what is a lesson, things like that.
Exactly.
It's like, yeah, it gets really messy. And in the original House bill, before it got passed to the Senate, that was the one that required teachers to identify two family or guardians of children who come out to them. So essentially, those teachers would be required by law to out those students, which aside from like the ethical and moral responsibility of that and that just being so backwards, the major damage that that can do to a kid and the major damage that that honestly can do to a community is pretty profound. I mean, you would be potentially opening that student up to violence at their home, abuse at their home, which can lead to violence in schools, can lead towards drug use, youth homelessness, high school dropout rate increasing, just a whole mess of problems that we don't need to contribute to at all. And this just giving someone the basic dignity and respect that they deserve could just avoid all of that in general.
And the position that we're putting teachers in after everything we've put them through in the pandemic is just absolutely unacceptable. It is ridiculous.
Exactly. Now, I'm not 100% sure if that got struck down when it got passed to the Senate. But the fact that that was even on the table in one of the seats of the legislature in Florida and passed one of the seats of the legislature in Florida is sickening and should disturb you.
All right. So let's get into how Disney has responded to this. And so we're giving you the most up-to-date information we have. I'm sure in between us recording this and you listening to the episode, there might be some further developments, but this is what we have right now. So initially, Disney decided not to take a stance on the bill, which, you know, as one of the, as a major corporation in the United States, as one of the largest employers in Florida, is beyond irresponsible. But it gets worse than that.
And in having a large portion of their employed members of the LGBTQIA plus community.
Yeah. So they were presenting this faux, like, you know, hands-off kind of stance. But the hypocrisy of that was revealed because the Disney company has given money to every single sponsor and co-sponsor of the bill, as reported by the Orlando Sentinel. There's absolutely no excuse for this since, for example, Florida Senate Republican Dennis Baxley has backed anti-gay legislation for years. So there is no way that Disney can pretend that they were just donating for the local government. They know what these politicians stand for. So Disney's initial response to the backlash that then ensued after that was reported was extremely pathetic, and it was spineless, and it's one of the worst statements I've ever read from this company. It stated, "For nearly a century, Disney has been a unifying force that brings people together. We are determined that it remains a place where everyone is treated with dignity and respect. The biggest impact we can have in creating a more inclusive world is through the inspiring content we produce, the welcoming culture we create here, and the diverse community organizations we support, including those representing the LGBTQ+ community." Please, spare me.
Yeah.
So then, CEO and just everyone's favorite guy, Bob Chapek, called Governor DeSantis on March 9th to allegedly discuss the company's quote-unquote disappointment should the legislation become a law. A spokesperson for the governor said, "This is the first time we have heard from Disney regarding HB 1557. The governor did take the call from Mr. Chapek. The governor's position has not changed. No in-person meeting has been scheduled yet." So scrambling, Chapek also announced, just to cover his ass, that Disney would donate $5 million to LGBTQ+ organizations, one of them being the Human Rights Campaign. Then, in the ultimate power move, the HRC rejected the donation, saying, "The Human Rights Campaign will not accept this money from Disney until we see them build on their public commitment and work with LGBTQ advocates to ensure that dangerous proposals like Florida's Don't Say Gay or Trans Bill don't become dangerous laws, and if they do, to work to get them off the books. Businesses have had and continue to have a major impact in the fight for LGBTQ+ rights, from marriage equality to the defeat of House Bill 2 in North Carolina and beyond. While Disney took a regrettable stance by choosing to stay silent amid political attacks against LGBTQ+ families in Florida, including hardworking families employed by Disney, today they took a step in the right direction, but it was merely the first step. HRC encourages Disney and all employers to continue to fight for their employees, many of whom bravely spoke out to say their CEO's silence was unacceptable, and the LGBTQ+ community by working with us and state and local LGBTQ+ groups to ensure these dangerous anti-equality proposals that harm LGBTQ+ families and kids have no place in Florida, et cetera, et cetera. This should be the beginning of Disney's advocacy efforts rather than the end." We went back and forth. Disney was like, "Oh, we're disappointed that they didn't take the money." Just like,
And I also want to add, I think one of the things that's really important that the HRC does in their statement is really acknowledge what the cast members and employees of the Disney company had done prior to the call that Chapek had with Ron DeSantis. The cast members and the employees issued a letter to the top leadership of the Disney company expressing their extreme frustration, disappointment. And then the same day as the call was the Disney shareholders meeting, where Bob Chapek was just grilled over and over and over again by folks asking what is going on, why he hasn't taken a stance, things like that. So There's a tremendous amount of pressure that has been put on the top leadership of the Disney company, specifically by the people that they employ, which puts them honestly in a very dangerous position, a powerful one, but a dangerous one as well in terms of retaliation. So Their bravery, their voices really are what's affected any sort of change thus far.
Yeah. And so in that case, respect to, I want to read two statements from two of those employee groups who have really taken a stand and separated themselves from the upper leadership of the Disney company. So employees at Pixar came forward addressing Disney's original statement, saying, "Even if creating LGBTQIA+ content was the answer to fixing the discriminatory legislation in the world, we are being barred from creating it." And then they went on to detail the way that, and I quote, "nearly every moment of overtly gay affection is cut from their films by higher-ups in the Disney company."
And that happens across all Disney films. Usually the reason why LGBTQ characters are sort of relegated to the background, it's so that they can easily be cut when these films are being sold overseas to countries and societies that are not tolerant in any particular way of LGBTQ people and their stories.
Disney Animation and Disney on Broadway, I think they both tweeted the same thing. They both said, to our LGBTQIA plus community in the studio and across the world, and I'm sure Disney on Broadway said the stage, Disney Animation stands by you. We denounce any legislation that infringes on your fundamental human rights. You deserve to be safe, respected, and able to live your lives as your whole selves, free from discrimination. So, the latest news that we have for you, it's a good thing. Don't get me wrong here. I'm glad about the statement that is the most recent that Bob Chapek has released. He announced that the Disney company will pause all political donations in Florida.
And he apologized.
Yeah, he said the words, "I am sorry." So this is the is the internal letter that he sent. To my fellow colleagues, but especially our LGBTQ plus community, thank you to all who have reached out to me sharing your pain, frustration, and sadness over the company's response to the Florida Don't Say Gay bill. Speaking to you, reading your messages, and meeting with you have helped me better understand how painful our silence was. It is clear that this is not just an issue about a bill in Florida, but instead yet another challenge to basic human rights. You needed me to be a stronger ally in the fight for equal rights, and I let you down. I am sorry. Our employees see the power of this great company as an opportunity to do good. I agree. Yes, we need to use our influence to promote that good by telling inclusive stories, but also by standing up for the rights of all. Starting immediately, we are increasing our support for advocacy groups to combat similar legislation in other states. We are hard at work creating a new framework for our political giving that will ensure our advocacy better reflects our values. And today, we are pausing all political donations in the state of Florida pending this review. But I know there is so much more work to be done. I'm committed to this work and to you all, and will continue to engage with the LGBTQ+ community so that I can become a better ally. You will hear more about our progress in the coming weeks. I truly believe we are an infinitely better and stronger company because of our LGBTQ+ community. I missed the mark in this case, but I'm an ally you can count on, and I will be an outspoken champion for the protections, visibility, and opportunity you deserve. Bob.
I think generally, there's a lot of good things that are happening in that statement. There's a lot of...
There's so much more ownership than there was up until this point, so I'll take that.
Yeah, yeah. Some of the things that I think are missing the mark. Well, one, these are words. These are not deeds thus far.
Yeah.
Pausing political donations so that you can review the process at which you donate to politicians. That, I think, is an important action step that you're doing. However, you're pausing all donations, including donations towards the people who are opposing this type of legislation. So it is sort of like... backwards a little bit there.
And, you know, I'm confused on that because, like, I am no expert in this arena at all. But I sometimes wonder, like, and I know that, like, in the, this is the perfect example where doing nothing in silence is complicity. But sometimes I'm like, okay, you're restructuring your political giving. How about you just fucking don't? Just don't give politically. But I guess everything is political. And like you said, we have to back the people who are doing the right thing. I don't know.
No. I totally understand that. Personally, I would love a world in which our corporations are not constantly lobbying politicians. However, the world that we're in right now is not that. And in order to move in that direction, we need to be ironically backing the politicians that are fighting to remove super PACs, things like that, from contributing towards our elections and really, you know, running the show in Washington and in local government. I think another one of the key things here is very recently Disney unveiled one of their new pillars of their efforts for diversity, equity, and that is inclusion. And that's one of their keys, rather. This was an exact moment where they were to put their words into practice. It was an opportunity for Disney to stand up by one of the new key values of their company, and they failed miserably. So that's where a lot of the frustration also is, because it's like, if you're going to be a little bit political about inclusion, you do need to be sponsoring the people who are also committed to those values that you have. But I agree. I sort of want to get to a world in which corporations aren't running the show.
It probably sounds naive, but yeah.
You know what? I I know what you mean in terms of like naivete there. I take it as a little bit of idealism. And I don't think that I don't want to sacrifice idealism all of the time.
Yeah.
Like I do think that pragmatism is important as well. Mm-hmm. But pragmatism with a compass and using idealism as your compass, I think that's important. Mm-hmm. Speaking of the actual, you know, politics process in all of this, I think it's easy to sort of just get caught up in the sort of like social aspect of it. But really what's happening here are some really, really strategic political moves that if you're not someone who pays attention to politics, I think it's something that's really important. So one of the things happening this year is the midterm elections. These elections are critically important, especially in local governments, like in Florida, like in Georgia, these states that are currently at really heated odds with one another of the ideals of these communities. And during midterm elections, especially for, you know, the party that isn't in power, what they try to do is flare up a lot of social situations to make high tensions and make things very, very polarized so that you can very clearly swing people one way or another. The other thing is you're trying to rush through a bunch of things that are important to you before you either lose your power or lose whatever you're trying to do. So what is happening here is legislation's being introduced in these states, these highly contested states, that they know is going to be sued by organizations like the ACLU or the Human Rights Campaign or organizations that are, you know, standing up for human rights. They're counting on the fact that they will be sued and that these issues will be taken to court, because then instead of playing out in the legislative or executive arenas, it's being moved to the judicial arena where there is much less say from the public. Mm-hmm. Things playing out in the courts can be appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court, where currently we have a conservative majority on the Supreme Court. So they're counting on all of these issues to go all the way up so that they can make a verdict and sort of change the law of the land outside of what the public really has any power to do. Because a lot of these people who are judges making these decisions are being appointed by our elected officials, and they're being appointed into lifetime seats. So in terms of things that we can do is to vote. You have a say in the people who decide these judges. In some cases, you have the power to decide who these judges are. Make good use of your time, research the people, commit to your values, put them ahead of everything, and make sure that you're voting for the people who are upholding your values and upholding human rights, in all honesty. But the other folks who have actual sway here are these mega corporations, the people who actually have the ear of these politicians, who are influencing their political campaigns and helping them run more than we, the public, are. And so this is an instance where Disney is actually one of the people who can affect the most change, and why the silence from a mega corporation like Disney has been so detrimental. They're simply standing by, letting things happen, when we, the public, trying to step in, can't necessarily move someone the way Disney could move someone. So that's why it's our responsibility also to keep pressure on these corporations to speak up, to take a stand in the way that we have with Disney, and has moved Chapek from saying nothing to apologizing. To bring a CEO to apologize to their employees, that's pretty terrific. And the employees of the Disney company have been, as many have said, the most angry and the most outspoken and disappointed that they have ever seen in the recent history of the company. So that's where our power is. And it's always important, and I take this right from Rachel Maddow, watch what people do, not what people say. All of these words from Bob Chapek, they are important, but it is our job to make sure that Bob Chapek, the leadership, the people that we put in power, are doing what they say they're going to do, doing what we want them to do. And that's our responsibility. And that's something that, yeah, it can be exhausting to carry that weight, and you can't always take it on. but you pass it on to someone else so that it's kind of like a choir. When one person needs to take a breath, they can take a breath, but other people are sustaining the note so that it's a constant pressure. It's constant. I love that. But one of the other things that I'll say here really has to do with this bill in general and why it is detrimental, because I do see a lot of things online of people saying, you know, kids in kindergarten and through third grade, they don't need to hear about all of this. They need to be, you know, doing this, that, and the other. No one is saying kids in kindergarten should be learning sex education. Contrary to what you think, LGBTQ issues involve more than just sex. It involves identity. And what this bill does is prevent kids from having conversations about the world they see, preventing schools from saying that having two moms or two dads is okay, that LGBTQ people are valid. And if you think kids in kindergarten through third grade aren't making opinions during this time, you are foolish and you are wrong. If you're thinking that they're just learning how to color and do their shapes in this time, you're wrong. They're learning to think. They're learning to make opinions. They're learning comprehension. They're learning foundations. This is the time that students are creating norms and baselines and defaults for themselves. Arguably, some of the most critical learning that happens in the life cycle of a human. By silencing one end of the conversation around identity, as students are forming their own identities, you are cementing and othering into this system. By preventing LGBTQ issues from being brought up in a safe and constructive learning environment, while cisgender heterosexual conversations can continue, you establish that this is normal and this is not. This is good or this is strange or bad. And you leave the door open for misinformation that can be harmful in the long term. And that's where this issue comes down. It's not about sex education. It's about letting kids have the freedom to learn and accept other humans for who they are. And this is just the beginning. We will continue to see bills like this introduced in other states, in states like Georgia. We've seen things come up in Texas as well. It continues to spread and it doesn't stop here, which is why it is critical that we speak up every single time because it's not okay. And it's not just about sex education. It's about identity and it's about teaching kids about the world that we want to create. And that's all I have to say about that.
Yes.
If you want to support organizations that are directly combating these types of legislation or support organizations that help LGBTQ families and individuals, look at the ACLU, look at the Human Rights Campaign, look at the Trevor Project. There are a bunch of organizations that really could use your support. So if you're feeling furious and you're thinking, what else can I do? Please take a look at those organizations and donate to them as well.
Yes. Yeah. And like you said, keep speaking out when you see really small instances of this in your own community. And I know there are a lot of things happening in the world right now that can make a lot of us feel very helpless and like there's nothing we can do. But like you said, basically, I mean, of course, it was largely very brave employees coming forward and speaking out. But also, outrage on the internet made a huge difference. Use your voice. It does make a difference, even though sometimes it can feel like we're shouting into the void. It really matters. And keep using your wallets to speak as well. I mean, Disney's a corporation at the end of the day. So, you know, I think the situation has improved over this week. But until it clears up to a place that you are comfortable with, you know, buy your Disney merchandise from a small shop. Don't give them any more money. They're going to feel it.
And when they saw the stocks plummeting, Chapek spoke out for the first time.
Yep, that's right. Also, Equality Florida was brought to my attention today, too, as another great place to donate to. So, yeah. Also, I know that, you know, it's a lot of us turn to Disney to escape. And so it's so incredibly disappointing when things like this happen. And just remember, don't be afraid to criticize the things that you love. If you really love them, you want them to be the best and most inclusive and least fucking evil that they can be, right? So we are going to continue doing that. Please, we're going to be honest about that, and we encourage all of you to do the same thing, and we're going to keep doing it as best we can.
Yeah. Who better to criticize something than someone who's coming at it with a place of love? Mm-hmm. We want this company, we want this escape to be a world that we can be proud of, that we escape into. All right. So with the conclusion of that mini rant, something that is extremely necessary in this time, we're going to get started with our full rant and rave episode. So This is the last rant and rave episode of season two.
Wow.
We're here already. And we're going to sort of end things in a similar place to where we began. So this episode, we are going to be looking at things in Disney that are nostalgic, that either have changed, could change, whether or not that's a good thing, whether or not that's a bad thing. I know this sounds really kind of muddy and murky, but trust us, it's gonna make some sense. Mm-hmm. But a lot of what it has to do is like some really like highly themed, interactive sort of nature of these things. But
yeah.
Just bear with us. You'll get it. So I have the rant this week. Caroline has the rave this week. Since we're already in a down sort of place, mm-hmm. I'm just gonna keep going with the rant.
Yeah, let's do it.
So for the past few days, I have gone fully down the rabbit hole. And today, I am going to be talking about the rise and fall, the modernization and destruction of the Disney Store.
Mm.
So I want to start out by acknowledging some of the sources that I went to as I was doing my deep dive. So D23, the Disney Examiner, AllEars.net, Jim Corcus, and Chuck Schmidt, they had some absolutely amazing Disney historian knowledge about this. So I want to give them the credit for really contributing to a lot of my research. I will also say what I'm about to give you is really just the tip of the iceberg, a blip in the bucket. So if you want to go crazy, but just be prepared that this is sort of an overture to how deep things really can go. So I'm going to start out by sort of talking about the history of the Disney Store, how it all happened, and then I'm going to talk a little bit more about, you know, some of my thoughts about what it should be, what it should have been, what this, that, and the other. So the first Disney Store opened on March 28th, 1987 in the Glendale Galleria in California. Up until this point, Disney was not operating any retail stores outside of Disney parks, apart from a small shop in the Orlando airport. Michael Eisner and Frank Wells decided to change the game by creating the first of its kind retailtainment store that has since been copied by other studios, entertainment giants, and corporations around the world. If you go to the NBC Experience store when you come to New York City, if you go to an HBO store, you go to a Universal store, you go to M&M store,
yeah,
Disney did it first. Mm-hmm. This is their legacy. So the Disney Store was designed to offer a retail experience that guests receive when they visit one of Disney's theme parks, but in their own backyard or shopping mall, really. So fully trained and costumed cast members were in each store to replicate the Disney magic that one would experience in the parks. And each store was highly themed. They were originally designed to look as if the characters from your favorite Disney films were coming out of the movies and into a store filled with whimsy and magic. The display windows in the front of the store were designed to look like film strips.
Yes.
So like the tops of it and the bottom, you know, would have like the black bars, and then you would look in and you'd see the character display or whatever's happening. It's like a film strip. Later, they would add the Mickey Mouse seal that appears at the beginning of all the classic Mickey shorts. That would be an inlay into the ground outside of the store, sort of beckoning you into the store. It was absolutely gorgeous. Inside the store were giant Disney characters hanging from the ceiling with film cells from classic Disney films bordering the store. Beautiful, lush, exquisite carpeting, just highly themed. And then the biggest feature was the mountain of stuffed animals and large projector screen in the back of the store that would play clips from Disney films and promotions for upcoming releases. You would go and you would just see so many stuffed animals and you could just sit there for hours and just watch things that you already had at home or you'd already seen, but you were in the Disney store. And these stores, they were filled with collectibles, knickknacks, apparel, all to bring Disney products just a little bit closer to home. So the Disney store model proved to be a great success and quickly grew to have their first overseas store in London in 1990, followed soon after by stores in Japan and Australia. A flagship store opened in New York City in 1996, as well as a location next to the El Capitan Theater in Los Angeles, home of Disney premieres, and that opened in 1998. So fueled by the success of the model and diving into a really previously untapped market, Disney continued to open more and more stores. And by 2001, Disney had opened, owned, and operated 700 Disney stores around the world.
Wow. Sheesh.
And so now, as they're growing, I'm going to talk about this next section that happened in the life of the Disney store, licensing and remodels. So following years of amazing success and growth of the Disney store, many of the executives responsible for that growth began to leave the company. So the mounting costs of continuing to open stores and then factoring in some of the lackluster periods of time for the Disney box office when, you know, early 2000s, a lot of the things that they expected to be hits were not really hits. DreamWorks was really becoming a high competitor. CG animation was, you know, being experimented with, all that sort of stuff. Disney began to start licensing the Disney store out as opposed to maintaining all of the operation in-house. So in 2002, they sold the Japanese Disney stores to the Oriental Land Company, while most North American stores were sold and licensed in 2004 to the Children's Place. And like a subsidiary of the Children's Place. So this is when some of the key troubles began for the Disney store. So Disney maintained control over many of the European stores, as well as a few of the North American stores, including the New York City Fifth Avenue flagship store. This store, however, was converted into a full World of Disney store. And the design modeled the elaborate and character-heavy theming of the World of Disney store in Orlando with that Art Nouveau style, giant character statement pieces and statues. Beautiful color schemes, whimsical lighting, things like that. So the Children's Place, who had most of the other Disney stores, they had hopes to continue the expansion and help the Disney store brand sort of move to the next stage of its life by creating outlet stores, opening even more stores. One of the great things with outlet stores is usually there's a very low operating cost for those, and you can lower the retail prices while resulting in a lot more profits. So it's a smart move. However, the strict licensing agreement from Disney resulted in some pretty intense licensing disputes between the two companies. This is around like High School Musical era time, just for reference. And then along with the requirement that the Children's Place highly invest in the remodels of the stores, that caused Children's Place to eventually sell the Disney store back to the Walt Disney Company in 2008. At this point in time, Disney announced that they were working with Steve Jobs and the design team behind the Apple retail store, Pompeii AD, to completely redesign and rebrand all Disney stores in this massive relaunch that they were originally calling Imagination Parks. And the goal was to sort of give a design to the stores that was rooted in the success of Apple retail stores, which emphasized high tech and a place where guests could interact with the products to create more of an experience. Like if you think about going into an Apple store, it's designed so that you're in there trying out the computers, playing with the iPod, playing around with the iPhone so that you learn to love it and then you can't leave there without it. So the first stores of this remodel, they opened in 2010. And then the new flagship store in Times Square after the Fifth Avenue World of Disney closed became the ideal model of the Disney store when it opened in 2011. These stores now featured theme sections that were based on different Disney properties, a castle centerpiece, walls that reflected the area's skyline or like the region's skyline with Disney characters in it, special lighting and projection designs, interactive areas for kids, which really sort of was a mirror that sort of tells you what Disney princess you are, and then like a glorified coloring station.
Yeah, I just want to say I visit the coloring station all the time and there's never any coloring pages there.
Great. Good to know. And then one of the other cool things is they did an opening ceremony to sort of mimic the experience of the Disney park. So all in all, there's a lot of really good things that are happening with this remodel. And it is sort of invested in that place that the Disney store sort of came from, of really trying to replicate that Disney magic experience that you get in Disney parks. Well, in 2010, the Oriental Land Company, switching all the way back over to Japan, they began to sell back their ownership of the Japanese Disney stores. And so the Walt Disney Company began to sort of grow their operation into China as well. However, at the same time, the chief executive of Disney Global Retail left the company, and the two senior vice presidents of the Disney store took over as the executive vice presidents of Disney Global Retail. And with this sort of came a shift into partnering with established brands and retail organizations, most notably JCPenney. And eventually the announcement happened in 2019 of quote unquote, shop within shops at Target in an effort to make Disney products even more widely accessible without Disney having to pick up the operation costs of running actual stores. So this is where the beginning of the end happens. So with the emphasis on e-commerce, partnerships with brands like JCPenney and Target, the fall of the American shopping mall, inflated Disney store prices, the Disney store traffic just was not what it once was. Closures began happening slowly, and then in March 2021, Disney announced that it would be focusing its efforts on e-commerce and closing at least 155 of the upwards of 300 remaining North American Disney store locations, which math tells you is more than 50% of the remaining stores in North America. Shortly thereafter, they announced in May of 2021 that they would be closing all European locations with the exception of a few handful of remaining stores. And as of September 2021, additional store closures in North America left only around 25 remaining stores nationwide, truly marking the end of the Disney store era. So thinking about what's next, there's a couple of things that are next. So Shop Disney. As of now, the main focus of the previous sort of Disney store operation is on the Shop Disney website, which brings together merchandise, collectibles, and more across all of the Disney properties and Disney parks as well. There are still certain items that are only parks exclusive and they can only be purchased while you're on Disney Resort property. But Shop Disney essentially allows for one place where most of the public-facing retail experience can live online. And they can sort of taunt you by saying, oh my God, you really wanted this? Well, you need to be in the park.
Don't even talk to me about it.
It's a little rude. It's a little rude. And it does sort of make sense from a, you know, we're trying to rake in as many profits as we can, because it means that now someone is like, okay, now my goal is I have to get to Disney.
Yeah, if I can get a friggin' reservation for this damn park. Yeah. Okay.
So on top of Shop Disney, the more sort of like Disney store-ish kind of like you go to a place, you pick up the thing that you want, that's existing with the store in a store model. So the partnerships that Disney continues to have with established retail companies like Target, those remain. Designated sections of Target feature Disney licensed products in what they called a store within a store. And this was in many ways their answer to the closures of the Disney store locations while still making physical Disney shopping widely accessible. Now, Disney's not picking up the operating costs, the super high standards of guest relations and experience. They're not responsible for delivering any Disney magic. After all, it's technically not their store. And then the third thing that's sort of like what next of the Disney store experience is, you know, what remains of the Disney store and World of Disney store, like in Disney Springs. So obviously some Disney store locations remain, including the one in Times Square, and World of Disney locations like the one in Disney Springs, previously Downtown Disney. And these open locations, however, they're very few and far between. And I will go on to say lacking some of the epic Disney magic that we had previously. I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail about the World of Disney store erasure because honestly, that could be an entire rant of its own and I can like fully do that. But with the redesign and rebranding of Disney Springs, the World of Disney store followed suit. So what was designed to be essentially the Disney store to end all Disney stores, it was originally created as a way to accommodate guests who were looking to purchase souvenirs and merchandise at the end of their trips because they would go through the parks, they would be holding off on making purchases, and then they'd be like, okay, now I need to go back to those parks because they were only available in certain locations, and then there was like a Disney shopping pass sort of situation, and that didn't really work.
Oh, yeah, that
so the world
messy.
Of Disney,
oof,
that was built as a direct need from what parkgoers were experiencing. And so the World of Disney in Downtown Disney, now Disney Springs, was built as a highly themed, gorgeous, again, Art Nouveau style, 50,000 square foot store that featured 10 unique rooms fully stocked with Disney merchandise. The store opened in 1996 and guests were literally given maps to guide them through all of the rooms, which were inspired by different characters and themes. The main hall featured 60-foot ceilings with stunning three-dimensional character airships that took direct inspiration from the characters in the original Disney store, but sort of elevating it to another level. It literally was like, what's working with the Disney store? Let's take that and let's just bring it up to another level. What they were trying to do was make World of Disney an attraction. And that was the future of the Disney store. And that's what we lost. So my sort of final thoughts on everything, I kind of want to look at stepping back the Disney store as a whole. I want to look at what we had, what we lost, and what we need. So what we had to start things off, I want to think about the Disney store in the 90s and early 2000s as I had experienced it in my childhood. Personally, stepping into these stores was pure magic for me as a kid. It was as if I was stepping for a brief moment into a Disney park. Like, I would come around the corner and I would see on the ground the edges of the Mickey seal. And it was like I was floating on the ferry boat, rounding the corner and seeing Cinderella's castle grow bigger and bigger in the distance. It was a little microcosm of that happening in my hometown, like in White Marsh Mall. It was amazing. And then like as a treat, I would get the Disney dollars that you could redeem in Disney
every
parks
Christmas.
And in Disney stores, which ultimately it was just a 1-to-1 American currency ratio. Like it didn't really mean anything, but it was kind
Mickey
of genius
on
their part. To, exactly. It was kind of because it was like you can redeem these in the Disney store and in the Disney park. Yeah. So it sort of like helped brand that extension of the Disney parks is what the Disney store thing is. And like they were fun. Like, it was great. And the appeal of the Disney store, yes, was Disney merchandise, the things that I could get. But even more so, it was the Disney magic. It was a feeling that you can't get anywhere else. Like suddenly you are surrounded by the characters and the stories that mean the most to you. And then at the end, you might get to bring something back home with you. And you didn't have to travel to Florida or to California to have that experience. You just had to go down the road a little bit. Mm. And I think this highlights the greatest purpose of these stores, which, like, yes, they're designed to bring Disney products closer to home. But the thing Disney had that no one else had was the ability to bring magic closer to home. And I think this was understood in the 90s with the creation of the World of Disney stores that sought to elevate the Disney store experience, even with more elaborate theming inspired by the original designs. The thinking around creating a store that is an attraction, that's the spin that is uniquely Disney. And I would even say that the Steve Jobs remodels, that was still embraced and understood. Like, while yes, the technology changed, looks became a little slicker, the stores were organized similarly to the parks, the opening ceremony, those mm-hmm. interactive elements like the mirror and stuff like that, the projection effects. Like, you know, when the store would open, they'd find a kid to unlock the door with a special key. Yeah. And then these projection effects would go off and it, like, the whole store would come to life. Like, that's cool. Those are things that you had to see. You had to experience. Now, what we lost, so with the investment in internet and e-commerce and the collaborations with these established brands, the experience or the attractionness is what is lost. And that's something that happens in person and with Disney's hand in it. We saw what happened when they started licensing things out. That magic dropped. Disney has to have their direct hand in it. The cast members, they create the magic because they know what it means. A Target employee, they don't give two shits about making the Disney section of the store feel more special. That's not the company that they work for. They're getting paid minimum wage for a company they probably don't care about and have a butt ton of other things to do. So, like, why would they go the extra mile? And why would we expect them to? Mm-hmm. And similarly, the Shop Disney website, that's not magic. It's another e-commerce store online. Like, in an effort to make Disney more accessible to people in their everyday lives, they sort of sucked out the why people would want it in their lives to begin with, which is the feeling, the escape, and the magic. And so what we need, this is an area that is severely lacking from Disney. And to be completely honest, with the current leadership, I'm not holding my breath that we will see any change in this. Not when profits are driving things more than they ever have with this company. And this is where I think the remodel of the Disney store, the Steve Jobs remodel, could have gone further. Instead of creating an opportunity for people to just ever so slightly interact with the products, immerse them. Take it even further. Make it so that the reason people are going to the Disney store isn't just about purchasing an item. It's an opportunity for them to have fun. It's an experience. And when you do that, people will buy more. Mm-hmm. And if we think that this type of model can't work, honestly, we need to look no further than the Harry Potter store that opened in New York City.
Exactly.
The theming, the products, mm-hmm. the VR experiences, yeah. the butterbeer. They've done what Disney was originally moving in the direction of from the beginning, creating attractions for people. And I would also say the Times Square Toys R Us store, that was similar to this as well. It was an attraction. It was something you had to see in New York. And honestly, every single time I went in, I bought something that I most assuredly did not need. Mm-hmm. And every time I went to New York City, I went to that fucking store because it was an attraction. You go in there and give people something free. And they'll enjoy themselves so much and they'll be surrounded by things that they can buy. They can't help themselves but to buy something on their way out.
Could you imagine if, like, you walked into the Times Square Disney store and you could get, like, you could buy a Mickey premium bar or something? I mean, please.
A Mickey pretzel? If I could get a fucking or Mickey a churro? Pretzel in the
oh,
city?
Oh my gosh. Yes. Yes. Like, yes.
Like that. Hello.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. So we're lacking the Disney magic experience that the Disney store once had when it opened. And rather than see that the essence of the Disney store, the magic of the Disney store was the gem, Disney continued to see its only value in churning out profits and products, which ultimately caters only to one group who wants to buy. Give people something else, give people an experience, and then you appeal to a wider audience who are not the people who go out of their way to shop for Disney products directly. You attract more people who are like, I would never usually go into the Disney store, but the Disney store in Times Square has so much stuff to do. Now I go into the Disney store and I bought something, and now you captured someone from your market who is not your niche.
Yeah.
So the attention to detail, the theming, that's what makes the difference. And I think the best example of how Disney is sucking the magic from the Disney store, apart from most of them being closed, is in World of Disney in Disney Springs. The character design, the whimsy, the Disney magic has been completely stripped to make the store yet another trendy corporate outdoor shopping mall, Old Navy looking bullshit that you see in your hometown. And Disney is supposed to be something else. Disney comes to your hometown to spread magic, not your hometown comes to Disney to dull it down. All is to say, I know that it had to happen because the theming of Disney Springs changed and blah, blah, blah. But just change the outside. You didn't have to change the inside. Like, why did you have to make it look like a fucking corporate American Apparel H&M bullshittery? No. We are craving Disney outside of the parks.
Yes.
Clearly.
Yes.
The hurdles to get to a Disney park, they are becoming more and more insurmountable. We relied on the Disney store before, and now it's gone. So give us back the Disney store. Give us our attraction. Give us a ride. Give us a restaurant. Give us fucking something. And that's the end of my rant, because I don't know where to go from there.
Yes, yes. You got me thinking, like, I am a target audience for the Disney store in Times Square in a way. Like, I love Disney. I'm willing to buy things. And it's right by one of the big audition centers in the city. And sometimes I'm like, oh, you know, if I'm sad after, I'll like walk through the Disney store. It's never a long visit, which is, you know, I'm a huge Disney fan. It shouldn't be that way. And I can't remember the last time I bought something from there, which again, I'm very susceptible to merchandise. So something's not going right in there, like you said, to make me stay and linger and buy something.
You need to give people a place that they can get lost in. And size doesn't matter. But in New York, honestly, kind of size does matter because that store is so small and you can get so cramped.
Oh, that's why I end up leaving too. Yeah, I'm tired of being pushed and shoved.
They needed to take over the Toys R Us store. When Toys R Us closed, they should have just bought that.
Yeah.
Because now they broke up that location. And like, I get it. That's probably the most insanely high property that you could possibly get in Times Square. And the rent was probably astronomical. But like, if Disney can't buy it, who the fuck can?
Yeah.
Honestly, they could have just kept the Toys R Us Ferris wheel and just rethemed all of the things as Disney.
Make it a Mickey Fun Wheel. Yeah. Make it another Mickey Fun Wheel.
Like, hello? Yeah. Hello?
Yeah.
Launch a fireworks show in there at the end of the night.
Build a theme park inside.
But they could have had an entire floor that was a Disney restaurant in there.
Oh.
Because there were like four floors in that
place. Also, there's no excuse for that, because in Harrods, the big department store in London, there is a Disney restaurant. There's like a little like Disney tea, like whole thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And like, when you think of like that old Toys R Us store, you had the Barbie Dream House that you could go into. Yes. You had the Jurassic Park area with the giant dinosaur. I actually loved the
Jurassic Park area. That was amazing.
It was awesome. And you had people out there demoing the toys.
So many demos, you could
just go up and play with the toys. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, they were doing that hands-on retail interactive experience and stuff like that. But it was such an attraction and literally had a ride in it.
There was a candy store.
You had to go. It was Candyland.
Yeah.
It was all Candyland themed.
Yeah.
You could have had a Goofy's Candy in like
a the Main parallel is too. Oh my God, you're killing me.
It's too much. Mm-hmm. It's too much. Mm-hmm. And it was a missed opportunity. But that's that. It's a crime.
Yeah. Yeah.
That we do not have the Disney store. And like, it was so simple when we were kids because like, you didn't have the internet and you didn't have all these other things. And like, the Disney store could arguably sort of like do less to impress us because like technology wasn't there. Mm-hmm. So like, yeah, you do have to invest in some technology here. But the thing that kept us coming back to the Disney store when we were kids, it wasn't the products. It wasn't the technology. It was just, it was the feeling.
Yeah.
And they let the feeling die. Mm-hmm. They didn't treasure the feeling because that was the most important part of the Disney store.
Ooh.
So that is a very, very abbreviated history. There's a lot more to discuss. If you're interested in this type of stuff, you can fall down the rabbit hole. I fell down the rabbit hole for 3 straight days. Like, do it.
You saw me. I was captivated when you had it. Just like, you had me.
Yeah.
Bravo. I enjoyed every single moment of that. That was brilliant.
Good. I don't really know what exactly I'm ranting about other than the fact that we don't have the Disney store. Like, I don't know what the theme is, but I have opinions and they're spicy opinions and I still don't even really know what they are targeted towards, but whatever.
Well, you know, if you think that, then that's an excellent segue into my rave.
Great.
Because as I was writing it, I was like, what's the thesis here? And although I'm not quite sure, I think there are maybe a couple of little mini ones, but it's also just, it includes a lot of thoughts I feel like I've had, what we've been discussing that I've had floating around about, just totally related to what you're talking about. Just like Disney's trajectory overall, leadership right now, it all ties together.
Yeah.
So I tried to title mine to just give it a little bit of a focus. So
all right.
The title of this rave is Immersive Dining in Walt Disney World, Never Change, or How the Hoop-Dee-Doo Review Changed My Life?
With a question mark?
With a question mark.
Oh, God bless. Publish this fucker. Put it on JSTOR.
Goodbye.
I'm buckling in.
Okay, here we go. Let's do this. As you said, too, I would like to thank All Ears Net, WDW Info, and the Disney blog for a lot of this info. So, the recent opening of the Galactic Star Cruiser experience in Hollywood Studios and the wave of cancellations that followed the influencer previews have me thinking a lot about immersive experiences in Walt Disney World and where else we can get them should sold-out experiences and large price tags prevent us from taking in some of Disney's newer offerings. But then I thought for a second, what about those cancellations? The Star Cruiser experience has received like generally positive reviews. But months that were previously fully booked now have openings. I think there's a completely separate conversation to have about the Star Cruiser. P.S. Disney, please invite us. We would be more than happy to experience it and let you know. But if I was working for Disney and I first heard this idea, I would expect it to be successful as it builds upon the concept of immersive dining and stays that Disney has been building upon for years to great success. Two immersive dining experiences that continue to be smashing successes come to mind, and I'm so glad that the large-scale changes to the park have left them both intact, with an asterisk, which I'll explain.
Okay.
I want to applaud Disney for not changing them, and I also want to look into why we should never, ever lose experiences like these in the parks. In fact, I believe they are the cornerstone of the Disney World experience. So one, the 50s Primetime Cafe in Hollywood Studios makes dining a truly immersive and nearly theatrical experience, while the Hoop-Dee-Doo Review at the Fort Wilderness Resort and Campground moves fully into the world of dinner theater, highlighting the vital connection between Disney World and live performers. Both experiences remain largely untouched since their opening days and unchanged. And just like the feeling that Connor described about the Disney store, these two places were absolutely magical to me as a kid and still are. And I'm so glad that guests can still have these experiences. Well, hopefully, because, spoiler, the Hoop-Dee-Doo Review has yet to reopen since it closed because of the pandemic. But we'll get there. Let's look at the development of both of these experiences. So let's start with the Hoop-Dee-Doo Review. Described as a hilarious, high-spirited hootenanny the whole family will enjoy, accompanied by a finger-lickin' countrified feast, the Hoop-Dee-Doo Review is a dinner show performed in Pioneer Hall at Disney's Fort Wilderness Resort and Campground. So the resort opened on November 19th, 1971, and at the time, what was then known as the South Seas Luau at the Polynesian Resort was selling out nightly, even having to turn guests away because it was so popular. There was clearly a guest demand for immersive entertainment outside of the theme park itself, which at the time would close around 6 p.m. Pioneer Hall, which, as I said, houses the show, opened on April 1st in 1974 and was originally intended as a dining hall. And it would host animal demonstrations, screen the True Life Adventures documentaries, and concerts by the Star Spangled Washboard Band. The original Fort Wilderness concept art included an outdoor stage for live performances, and perhaps the combination of guest demand for live resort entertainment and the original plans for the resort is what led Robert Janney, Ron Miziker, Tom Adair, Paul Suter, and Larry Billman to start developing a concept for a show. Its title evolved from, and this one really gets me, what did this mean? The first title for the show was "We're With You, Mother McCree."
Is that the name of the what? Episode?
Oh my god. What?
We're with you,
Mother McCree. I gotta find out more about that. I'll get back to y'all on that. Oh my gosh. Then it became the Whoop-De-Doo. And then it became the title we know today, eventually directed by Billman and choreographed by Forrest Bayreuth. So inspired by Hollywood stereotypes, Billman created the six characters of the show. Dolly Drew and Six-Bit Slocum, who were the comic relief duo. So if you've ever seen pictures of the show, if you've never seen it, you'll see Dolly in pigtails and a red checkered skirt and Six-Bits in checkered pants. Then we have the ingenue couple, Jim Handy and Flora Long. They both wear yellow. And Johnny Ringo and Claire DeLune. They are the outlandish dancers, Claire in multicolored striped dress and Johnny in brown. The concept of the show is that the troupe's stagecoach broke down outside of Pioneer Hall and the performers decide to put on a show for the crowd inside while it gets repaired. The show includes singing, dancing, vaudeville comedy, and audience participation. We are told the legend of Davy Crockett. We hear classic songs like the Old State Song. We play washboards and we swing our checkered napkins for dear life. I love what one of the later directors of the show, Alan Bruhn, says about the characters. He said, "You've got those three love relationships, all of which play out at different speeds in different ways. Maybe tonight's the night that Jim Handy is going to finally commit and pop the question to Flora. Maybe Six Bits and Dolly will stop cracking jokes long enough to realize how they feel about each other, and so on. We've got this sort of worldly microcosm, which all good theater is." So the show was first developed as part of the Disney World Fine Arts College Workshop, which was an internship program. And it was basically put together as a filler show that nobody expected to last. But it was a smashing success after its first 11 weeks. So when the college students who were interning went back to school, Disney held auditions and cast professional actors to fill the roles starting in September 1974.
Why would I go back to college?
Exactly. That's a great question. So during the show, the audience is fed an all-you-can-eat meal of buckets of fried chicken and barbecue ribs, green salad, baked beans, cornbread, and strawberry shortcake for dessert, with prices ranging from $66 to $74 for adults, depending upon your seating location.
I would pay that right now. Oh, my God.
This is what I'm saying. Okay, may I just say, too, the food here is not an afterthought. It is really good. I haven't been in a long time, but when I was looking things over, I also found that this price, if you are over 21, includes unlimited sangria, draft beer, and wine. And let me just say, I'm ready to hit it now. Like, open it and I will be there because you don't have to pay theme park admission to get in there. I'll drive down to Orlando.
I'll rent one of the cabins. The cabins are super fun, even though they're just like single wide trailers. But like, fuck it.
Why do I feel like people are going to see us completely just twisted at the Hoop-De-Doo?
I've stayed at Fort Wilderness.
Oh, so
it was great. I could take a boat across the Magic Kingdom.
Yeah.
We had the petting zoo. My dad tried to get a peacock feather that he would yank out of a peacock because they had an albino peacock. We loved Fort Wilderness.
Oh, fun. I really want to do that one day. So all of this comes together to make the Hoop-De-Doo Review one of the longest running stage shows in America. At one point, Disney even considered expanding to a 1,500-seat outdoor theater to meet guest demand for the show.
Oh, God.
And also, that plan sounded amazing because then the stagecoach was actually going to fully pull up in front of the theater. It sounds amazing. This show, when it's open, of course, which I am praying it returns very soon, performs 21 times per week and has been open for over 45 years, performing to over 10 million guests, many of whom return to the show again and again. And as I mentioned, it has not reopened since the pandemic. Before we get into why this is so necessary, why we need to reopen the show and rehire the performers, let's go over to the 50s Primetime Cafe. Dinner theater like the Hoopty Doo Review is going to be immersive by nature, but I also want to take a look at the 50s Primetime Cafe in Hollywood Studios. It brings an immersive theater experience to what is still a typical table service restaurant, and I think it's one of Disney's most unique and memorable experiences. The Primetime Cafe opened in 1989 in what was then Disney MGM Studios. It was so successful that it led to the opening of another fantastic table service immersive dining experience, the Sci-Fi Dine-In, 2 years later.
Which is my favorite in Hollywood Studios.
It's wonderful. So I almost talked about that too.
For those of you who don't know, Sci-Fi Dine-In, you sit in cars.
Under the night sky.
Yeah, under the night sky. And you watch B-roll ads for like sci-fi B-movies, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
It's so good.
Yeah, it's wonderful. So the Primetime Cafe theme is best described as 1950s kitsch, with shows like Leave It to Beaver and Topper playing on black and white televisions as guests sit surrounded by home goods and knickknacks. We've probably all seen at our grandparents' houses. It's extremely realistic. The last time I went with my parents, they were counting the items that they actually had in their homes when they were kids. So you enter the restaurant through the wood-paneled tune-in lounge and into Mom's kitchen to make it into a living room-inspired dining area. The waitstaff at Primetime are not only dressed a la characters from Leave It to Beaver, but they spend your meal in character, acting like the mom, pop, or other domineering family member of the table and dishing out sass and discipline when necessary. I will say, I think this effect has softened over time. I recall, and maybe this was because I was a child, I was scared of them as a kid. I was very nervous. I was like, I loved it at the same time, but they made me nervous. But there was also a concerning period in the 2000s when it felt like the performances by the servers were kind of being abandoned. But then, as of my last visit in 2018, the cast members are truly providing character and performance to die for. I had a wonderful experience.
Character. Elegance.
Character. And elegance. The menu is filled with American comfort food classics like Aunt Liz's fried chicken, Mom's pot roast, which is my favorite, Dad's chocolate peanut butter layer cake, and what are rumored to be the best milkshakes on Disney World property. The interesting thing is I couldn't find really any information, and I looked far and wide, on how and why this restaurant was developed. So if anyone out there has a source or some info, please share it with me because this concept is brilliant and I'm dying to know how it came about. And it was, I'm not saying it was the first of its kind ever, but it inspired a lot of experiences in the Orlando area and elsewhere that came after it. So I need to know more.
Yeah, like Whispering Canyon Cafe follows the same model,
yeah.
And that's in the Wilderness Lodge.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, not a 50s primetime model, but the model of like teasing your guests and things like that.
Exactly. Yeah. So I would love to know more. Please, if anybody has that info, please share it. So now that we've got the histories, here is why we need these experiences and why they should not change. So number one, they are relatively affordable. On a basic level, we cannot all afford the Galactic Star Cruiser. You will pay a base price for the full experience at Hoopty Doo, dinner and a show. And at Primetime, you can order whatever works best for your budget. It seems like Disney is slowly but surely losing tiered experiences like this, in which guests can still get the only in Disney moments while being able to control how they affect their wallet. These kinds of tiered experiences are the key to the longevity of the Disney World experience, if you ask me. With these two experiences specifically, guests also have a bit of control over how much they interact with the performers, and are a part of the story themselves. Some people are far too shy to have the Star Cruiser experience and be a full-ass character for 2 days. Like, to me, listen, I'm a performer, but that kind of sounds exhausting to me. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah, that feels like work.
It's a muscle
work. That's what we do. That's what we do for work.
Exactly. I'm like, I don't know.
When we're lucky.
Yeah. But guests should still have the ability to be fully immersed in a story. These experiences allow modulation, and this is key. Also, not for nothing, I'm sure a lot of the ire directed at the Star Cruiser is because of the price tag of the experience. When we pay less for something, we're going to be a little bit more forgiving. So, okay, like a corny moment doesn't land at Hoop-Dee-Doo or Primetime, truly no harm done, because what it cost us to be there isn't going to make or break our lives when we return back home. They should be, there's less pressure on them.
Yeah, whereas if Cinderella does not come around to your table at Cinderella's royal table and you spent all of that fucking money, you're gonna notice it.
Yeah, yeah, and people do, and people get pissed. Also, immersive experiences, and dare I say dining specifically, I think are the heart of Walt Disney World. These two experiences feel like the epitome of Disney magic, which to me is this very specific combination of these ingredients. Personal, nostalgic, immersive, and fun. I personally now go to Disney to be a part of a story, forget the real world, feel something for once, and honestly now eat really good food. Yeah. That is a huge part of it for me. That combination can't really be found in real, quote-unquote, real-world vacations to the same degree, and this is something I feel that Disney truly owns. Other theme parks have the rides, they have the tech, they even have the food now, but they really don't have anything like these two experiences. There are internet threads where guests share their funny stories from their visit to Primetime and like what the servers did and said to them, and I have one too. I've mentioned it on here before. Shout out once again to Aunt Janice, who was my server in October 2018. My family and I, we talk about her. We're never going to forget her. She was constantly telling me to put my phone away, and then she eventually slid right into the booth next to me and took a selfie with me that I am going to keep forever. She also yelled at my dad for asking for extra cherry syrup in his Coke, and I have a video of her absolutely just dumping the stuff, like overflowing his glass, just dumping cherry syrup into it. And like my parents are cracking up. Everyone around is watching and laughing. It's like an incredible moment. This is Disney magic.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like you were saying, ultimately, although we love new technology and innovative ride experiences, and I'll always be looking forward to those when I return to the parks, if I ever return, this is what keeps us coming back. Can we afford it? Of course. It's human connection.
It's the cast members. The cast members are the magic.
And kind of, you know, as I was writing about this, I was feeling a little sad. It feels like it's starting to slip away from the Disney World experience. One, because as we've talked about throughout this episode, we have yet to rehire many cast members. But it's also, you know, I feel like a lot of this is getting replaced by what's the most tech-savvy thing that we can insert into the parks. And what else are people writing about on the internet in that way that's on the newer side? I can't think of anything.
Yeah.
Also, another reason why we need these is, as we've already mentioned, it's the live performers. Live performers keep experiences fresh and relevant. Live performers are the key to stopping the disappearance of a lot of the Disney magic and nostalgia that many of us are experiencing right now. They eliminate the need for the destruction of classic material and attractions and experiences, because modern performers can't help but bring their sensibilities to the experience that prevent things from becoming simply a dated time capsule.
Yeah.
They're a smart business decision. And I really freaking wish the Disney parks would start seeing that and valuing their performers. We're going to go into a mini rant, but I'll bring it back around. There have been many conflicts between Actors Equity, which for those who don't know is the Stage Actors Union and Stage Managers Union, and Disney Parks. I don't take issue with this because I think union performers are superior in any way. I also, you know, I think Equity actually does a pretty crappy job at protecting its members a lot of the time. But in the theme park environment, the union puts health and safety measures in place and like working hours in place that preserve the dignity of people working at the park. Performers are the ones who elevate the parks, and they may be the ones to turn things around. So Disney, hire them freaking back and watch the real magic happen. I kid you not, the Hoop-Dee-Doo Review And I honestly had forgotten about this until I was reading about the characters. I was looking at pictures and I remembered we have a home video of this. I have to find it. But the first time I ever went to Hoop Dee Doo, we were sitting in the balcony. And I remember watching Flora, who's like the ingenue character, and like she had the most beautiful singing voice. And I remember, because I can still see it in my mind's eye, I can see myself looking down at her and she was on the ground level in the audience. And I was captivated and I was like, I'm going to do that. And it's like these gigantic life moments, like, you know, me having some like semblance of an idea that I wanted to be a performer, and like people come to the Hoop Dee Doo for wedding anniversaries.
Yeah.
Like every single performance. It's things like this that can only happen when we have human-to-human connections. And so ultimately, here's why I think a lack of change in the parks, in this case, is a great thing. Just like I've read many internet accounts of people's primetime memories, I've also read about so many families who come back to Hoop Dee Doo through literal generations. The show has remained nearly completely unchanged since the 70s, except for two things. They switched out one song because of a rights issue, and strawberry shortcake became the dessert instead of apple pie. That's it. And guests continue to pay money on top of their theme park admission to see a show from the 70s. We need cornerstones like this in a place that was built for memories and for family. There needs to be something recognizable about the parks and moments that evoke core memories. As an adult, yeah, I definitely go for the new rides and the new food festivals and the new hotels, but the moments that actually matter to me are the ones that I've been doing with my family for years, and I use as a way to like measure me growing up, my family growing and changing. And that's the only thing in Disney that I cannot get anywhere else. Now, of course, I'm all for good changes that we've discussed on this podcast, like in our pilot episode.
Forgive the audio.
In which, you know, Red was added to the Pirates of the Caribbean. Sorry. We were just figuring things out. But I am so grateful that Hoop Dee Doo has hopefully survived the pandemic and that primetime didn't fall during the massive overhaul of Hollywood Studios and Hollywood Studios just figuring out what it is. Neither experience is flashy or techie, but they are both rich and necessary, and guests want and love them. Stop changing the things that guests love for the new and the flashy. And so my final thought, I actually don't think, bringing it back to the Star Cruiser, just because it's been on my mind, I don't think the Star Cruiser as a concept is a bad one at all. I even, in a small way, think that the price point is a tiny bit understandable because Disney is blessedly employing union performers. You're being fed. You're staying there. It's still a lot of money. Don't get it twisted. But there need to be different accessibility levels for these immersive experiences. We need more of them. And guess what, Disney? Some of them need to be free. Like, for example, the Citizens of Hollywood
Citizens
Boulevard.
Citizens of Hollywood. There it is.
And, oh, wait. I remember another thing. The Magical Express. That's what brings you from the real world to Disney World. And it was free, and it is gone. Needing to level up financially in order to be immersed is now becoming the norm. And without these experiences as a part of the base price of admission, sure, yes, you're buying your meal too, but like at least you're getting something. You're being fed.
Yeah.
I'm starting to feel confused about what Disney World is even trying to be anymore. So I know that sounded like a rant, and it sort of was, because we're feeling a lot of sad feelings lately. But I do just want to reiterate, I'm so happy that these two experiences still exist from the 70s and 80s, because we can't say that about really much else in the parks.
Mm-hmm.
I think of right away, the Great Movie Ride. And I am just so glad that they're still here. When they are available, when you go to the parks, please go and enjoy them. The Hoop Dee Doo, it's incredible. And I'm also just glad that we can see things in their original form as well. That's also something special. And that's also something to me as people who study Disney in a way.
Yeah.
That's special and it's necessary.
Well, I don't really have anything to add, because I feel like we did sort of find the through line between our two things. I think a lot of it really has to do with, in terms of, yes, immersion changes nostalgia, but I think it also has to just do with Disney magic in general. And Disney magic comes from the cast members.
Yes.
The cast members make the difference of the Disney store.
Yes.
The cast members make the difference of these experiences.
That's exactly right. Yep.
And the cast members are asking for Disney to stand up and defend them. And the cast members are asking you to hire them back and respect them and value them because they're the magic. Without them, we're nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I don't really think I have anything else to add. I don't think I have anything more I can spend in this episode.
I know.
But thank you all so much for listening to this episode. If you liked what you heard, please remember to hit follow or subscribe wherever you're listening to the podcast. That way all of our new episodes download to your devices. You don't miss out on anything. And please hit a 5-star rating if it's available. Leave a few words of a review because, as I said at the beginning, we're in the dark timeline and those words of encouragement really mean a lot to us right now. And they go a long way in terms of just helping us reach other people, grow the podcast, and help us make sure that this is something that's worthwhile that we're doing. So thank you for taking the time to do that. It really means a lot.
Also, we would love if you would follow us on social media. So we are at Poor Unfortunate Podcast on Instagram and Facebook and TikTok.
Oh, yeah. We're on TikTok.
Don't expect much from the TikTok, but we are on there. So
we don't always post, but we're on it.
Yeah. But we're there and we love the support. And we are at Unfortunate Pod on Twitter. We always have some new things going on there. We do a lot of polls. We love hearing your feedback on there as well. And if you want to talk even more about these episodes, about the abundance of Disney news, please join our private Facebook group, The Poor Unfortunate Fam. We're reaching 100 people over there. We discuss the episodes. We go over, like I said, Disney news. We take quizzes. It's also just nice for us to, you know who's listening out there, although so it's not, you know, just like an anonymous crowd in our
speaking
minds.
Speaking to the void.
Yeah, yeah. It's really special to get to know you, and we would love to have you join us there. And just also, you know, mom, speaking of that side note, this is not related to social media, but just like it is a tough time right now in a lot of different ways. We're hitting 2 years since the pandemic, and just the news is, there's just a lot. So I just hope that y'all are taking care of yourselves and drink your water. Also, please, like, I think the fam is a great place to just, like, talk about Disney things and talking about something lighter and find a sense of community. And I just hope that you feel that even if you don't join us in the fam, I hope that you feel that when you listen to this podcast. I hope it brings you some relief. And if you're out there and you're having a hard time right now, just know that we really are thinking of you and we're sending a lot of love.
Yeah, we're with you. And lastly, it does take us some money to keep this podcast up and running and coming to y'all. We do have a PayPal account, and that is linked in our episode description, as well as the website links in our social media accounts. Truly anything that you have to spare, it goes a long way for us. It really just helps us cover the basic costs of keeping it all going. You can make a one-time donation, you can make a monthly donation, you can make it $5, $10, more than that. All of it just goes right back into the podcast, helps us keep it free, for the most part, ad-free as well. So thank you very much for considering that. And if you want to save the money that you might honestly send our way and donate to one of those critical organizations that's fighting this type of legislation and supporting LGBTQ communities, please do that. Do that. Please. So thank you for that consideration. Thank you for supporting different organizations and things that are trying to help people. Okay. Sorry, I disassociated for a quick second. I did. Okay. Well, until next time, folks, I'm Connor. Oh, wait, we don't do that. Well,
sure, and I'm Caroline.
Okay, great. I'm Connor. That's Caroline. This is the Poor Unfortunate Podcast and Beluga Savruga. What the hell?
I want to keep that in.